Thank you. Thank you. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here. I think it is so important to maintain these concrete connections to Freud's home, to the home in London, and I'm really honored to be here, and I want to thank the organizer. I'm looking forward to the conference tomorrow. I do have a subtitle, which is three episodes of mass psychology. The election of Donald Trump, taken along with the Brexit vote, marks a world historical rupture in Anglo-American liberal hegemony. Yet it is a rupture that cannot be understood within a liberal framework. The reason is that liberal societies presuppose the rational and self-interested individual, while they rest on non-rational mass collectivities, such as those of religion, race, and nation. Today, the term populist is often used to denote the mass politics found in liberal societies, but this term is often empty, ambiguous, and tendentious. In this paper, I want to suggest a different approach by drawing on the Freudian and Freudo-Marxist legacy. I will not directly address the Trump and Brexit phenomena, but what I will do is trace three moments in which a Freudian approach to mass psychology developed and proved valuable to the 20th century left. I call the three moments repression, sublimation, and regression. The first moment, repression, was marked by the discovery of the role of the father complex as part of the struggle against fascism and also against racism. The second moment, sublimation, was basic to the critique of mass culture, or what Adorno called the culture industry, but was also basic to a Freudian-inflected cultural radicalism. The third moment, regression, uncovered the narcissistic basis of mass society, or the society of the spectacle, during the 1960s, culminating in women's liberation and gay liberation, and presaging today's anarchistic and antinomian protest culture. The three moments were cumulative. The second developed, that's the sublimation, developed out of the first, repression, and the third, regression, developed out of the second. They therefore constitute a tradition, albeit one that is largely unrecognized today. They constitute a tradition. To understand this tradition, we have to situate it against the classical liberal ideal of individual autonomy and reason. According to Karl Shorsky, a statue of Athena stood in front of the mid-19th century Viennese parliament. In other words, the basic idea was self-government rested on reason. This ideal was upended when the masses entered the political process in such forms as crowds, working class strikes, mass demonstrations, mass or celebrity culture, and the new populist, often anti-Semitic politics of the 1890s. In 1895, a police psychologist, Gustav Le Bon, wrote The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind, to express the problem the masses supposedly posed. Le Bon showed, his argument was, showed how credulous crowds were, how easily rumors, false prophets, and irrational fears or passions misled the masses. Even though social democracy profoundly revised the liberal tradition of the individual by stressing collective action, collective responsibility, collective security, collective bargaining, even though neoliberals revived the contrast between the rational individual and the irrational group or mass, as we see in the generally derogatory use of the term populism today. The most important innovation of Freud's 1921 group psychology and the analysis of the ego was to reject this contrast between the individual and the group. In his opening paragraph, Freud wrote, quote, "The contrast between individual psychology and social or group psychology, which at first seems so full of significance, loses its sharpness when it is examined closely. In the individual," still Freud, "in the individual's mental life, someone else is invariably involved as a model, as an object, as a helper, as an opponent. And so from the very first, individual psychology is at the same time social psychology as well. In place of the distinction between individual and group, Freud suggested a different distinction between the individual's relation to others and what he calls, I'll quote again, certain other processes described by us as narcissistic, in which the satisfaction of the instincts is partially or totally withdrawn from the influence of other people," end quote. Freud then went on to argue that groups are formed through a psychological process very close to narcissism, namely identification. In a crowd, individuals substitute the image of a leader or an idea for their own ego ideals, which allows them to identify with one another. This is a regression, but for Freud, regression is not necessarily negative, in contrast to Le Bon, for whom the crowd represented degeneration or decline. Furthermore, in 1921, Freud did not have the still deeper concept, later developed by Melanie Klein, of projective identification, which describes the corporeal ways in which individuals feel parts of themselves are inside other persons, or that other persons or parts of other persons are inside them. Let me turn now to the three moments I will be discussing, moments that Freud would have called, did call, applied psychoanalysis insofar as he experienced them. The first moment, provoked by the experience of fascism in Europe, was largely the work of Wilhelm Reich. According to Reich, fascism arose from a longing for protection, an idealization of the strong man. In the US, the lynch mob was likened to the fascist crowd. I call this stage repression because the underlying theory was that both fascism and racism are based on sexual repression, and that revolutions occurred through the liberation of the instincts. A moment's reflection on the fascist crowd or the lynch mob showed how misleading this assumption could be. The realization that one could not simply unleash repressed instincts led to a second phase in the history of applied psychoanalysis, which centered on the individual's ability to resist mass or group pressure, an idea linked to sublimation or the strengthening of the ego through the postponement of instinctual satisfaction. In this phase, Freud's group psychology was applied to such characteristics of mass consumption society as celebrity culture, but also to fascism. During World War II, the critique of fascism, which was the first form of applied psychoanalysis or political Freudianism, and the critique of mass consumption, which was the second, converged. Finally, we have the third, and in some ways most difficult phase, the mass or crowd psychology that characterized the new left, and which the early feminist and gay liberation crowds, groups, both adopted and transformed. Insofar as they drew on Freudianism, these movements were reacting to the sterility and conservatism of the earlier emphasis on the ego. Influenced especially by Herbert Marcuse's reading of primary narcissism as paving the way toward a post-productionist, post-bourgeois society, and Norman O'Brien's interpretation of psychoanalysis as a sort of mysticism of the body, new leftists embraced the great crowd formations of the epoch in the form of the call for participatory democracy. I call this third phrase regression in Freud's sense of the term, meaning a return to earlier stages of the mind, And I will argue that the 60s witnessed creative political uses of regression. The first episode of applied psychoanalysis, this is the father complex, the first episode of applied psychoanalysis was based on the idea that mass politics is animated by the longing for protection associated with the father. What gave this idea special force was the emergence of a generation of dictators, such as Mussolini and Hitler, who drew on the mass media and other forms of mass organization, such as parades, sports events, and film, to project themselves as father figures to enthralled nations. Paul Federn's 1919 pamphlet, The Fatherless Society, may have been the first Freudian description of this phenomenon. Responding to the 1919 Spartacist uprising in Vienna, Federn argued that the revolution would fail because the Social Democrats, quoting from Federn, were tied to the basic attitude of the sun, meaning they allied with the military government in the hope of gaining protection and favors. And the revolutionaries had turned the original tie to the father into instinctual hate. In the late 1920s, Wilhelm Reich applied the same model to the Nazis. When the Nazis became the second largest party in Germany, the question of whether the middle class would support them became pressing. Drawing on the supposition that the middle class was an intermediate and dependent class, Reich predicted that they would. Likening the white-collar worker to an eldest son with a powerful father, he wrote, "While subordinate to the top, he is to those below him a representative of authority and enjoys as such a privileged moral, not material, position." The arch personification of this type is to be found in the army sergeant. This view of fascism as rooted in especially male desires for both power and submission has had a long history, most recently exemplified in Klaus Thelwight's Male Fantasies. Reich's theory of mass psychology was not restricted to fascism. In 1928, he toured the Soviet Union, visiting nursery schools and pedagogical centers. Lecturing in Moscow, he distinguished Freudianism as a theory of mass psychology from what he called the Freudist worldview, psychologization, which he urged leftists to reject. His report on the visit, The Sexual Revolution, praised the undermining of patriarchal authority in the Soviet collective farms, but warned that threats to ban homosexuality and abortion foretold the revolution's collapse. The last translation of Freud into Russian appeared in 1930. Freud wrote to his Russian translator, again a quote from Freud, "From somewhere, the Bolsheviks have caught the opinion that psychoanalysis is hostile to their system. You know the truth, that our science is not able to be put into the service of any party, but that it needs a certain liberal-mindedness. Freiheitlichkeit." In the Freudian theory of groups or masses, as I've said, it was not necessarily the father symbol that united a crowd. It could also be an idea, such as nationality, ethnicity, or skin color. This insight made it possible for the first wave of Freudians to analyze not just dictators, but also the lynch mob, which developed in the United States in the new or capitalist South of the 1890s after patriarchal slaveholding had been abolished. In the lynch mob, the identification is not based on a leader, but on an idea, namely that all white people are equal. In his 1940 autobiography, W.E.B. Du Bois illustrates how Freudianism developed out of the limits of liberalism. Du Bois recalled that as a young man, he had thought of the Negro problem, as quotes from Du Bois, he had thought of the Negro problem as a matter of systematic investigation and intelligent understanding. But then a poor Negro in central Georgia, Sam Hose, had killed his landlord's wife. "I wrote out a careful and reasoned statement concerning the evident facts and started down to the Atlanta Constitution office. I did not get there. On the way, news met me. Sam Hose had been lynched, and they said that his knuckles were on exhibition at a grocery store. In the fight against race prejudice, Du Bois wrote, we were not facing simply the rational, conscious determination of white folk to oppress us. We were facing age-long complexes stuck now largely to unconscious habit and irrational urge. Criticizing his earlier conviction that race prejudice was based on widespread ignorance, Du Bois concluded that he had not been sufficiently Freudian in the sense of not understanding how little human action is based on reason. These are roll quotes. How should we evaluate this first moment in applied psychoanalysis? Restricting ourselves to Reich, we can applaud his efforts to call attention to the political applications of psychoanalysis. But note that his thought was based on a mistaken model. For Reich, liberalism stayed at the surface, fascism mobilized secondary drives, such as sadism, envy, and greed, while a psychoanalytically informed revolution would penetrate to the deepest layer, the instincts themselves. Reich assumed that in liberating sexuality, especially the sexuality of women and young people, one would liberate the revolutionary impulse. But the examples of fascism and the lynch mob showed that instinctual release could be anything but benign. No wonder then that so many Freudians, including Du Bois, opposed Reich's equation of emancipation with the release of the instincts. In their view, those who suffered from authoritarianism or racist or anti-Semitic scapegoating could not merely throw off their repression and revolt, but rather had to work through their experience in the process of building emancipatory movements. The distinction between throwing off repression and working through led to a second stage in the history of psychoanalysis, the so-called structural theory, ego, id, and superego, and this distinction became central to the second episode of applied psychoanalysis to which I now turn, and that's the episode of consumer society. The second episode was the, application of psychoanalysis to understanding mass consumption societies, such as the US in the 1920s, which is what I'll talk about. The 1920s was the era of youth revolt, a loosened attitude towards sexuality, bobbed hair, the Harlem Renaissance, and the modernist novel, as well as the moment in which Freudianism became mixed up with modernist culture. In many ways, one can see this second episode as an effort to disentangle Freudianism from the cultural explosion of mass consumption in which it was caught up. This effort centered on the attempt to understand culture itself, which was a new idea, took a new form in the 1920s, or rather to understand two related levels of culture. First, mass culture, which took such forms as advertising, film, radio, celebrity, public relations, and what is today called spin. And second, the layers of culture, of cultural depth, that formed such modern identities as the new woman, the new homosexual, the new Negro, Zionism, and so forth. Let us look first at the new mass culture. The important point is that it was a culture of release, the overthrow of puritanical or Victorian restraints. In other words, what Reich hoped for in Europe seemed to be in the process of being realized in the US. A 1922 essay by Carl Abraham shows how Freud's theory of group psychology could be deployed to analyze this culture of release of mass consumption. The essay concerns Emile Coué, who was a French radio personality who taught his listeners to repeat a mantra, "Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better." The radio audience, in this case, is the group. In Abraham's analysis, the members of the audience, the members of the group, did feel better after listening to Kuei. The reason is that Kuei magically, but temporarily, allowed his listeners to overcome their conflicts by treating them all equally, refusing to play favorites, putting everyone on the same level. The proof was that he gave everybody the same gift, which was the mantra. Kuei then was a good father. This is an example of how a modernist culture of release bolsters narcissism, but avoids the problem of working through, which is the problem of the second episode. Freud did periodically advocate releasing the instinct from excessive or civilized, was his word, which meant Victorian, demands. But he spoke more often, especially after World War I, of sublimating the instincts. Sublimation, according to Freud, required abstinence, one of his favorite terms, or delayed gratification, in order to transform sexual and aggressive energies into insight. Freud's famous slogan, "Where id was, there shall be ego," can be restated as, "Where release was, there shall be sublimation." Freud's use of the term sublimation, furthermore, differed sharply from the Victorian use of the term, which implied uplift. Unlike the doctors and reformers who invited Freud to the United States in 1909, in that first famous visit, in the hopes that psychotherapy would elevate the immigrant masses, the 20s generation welcomed Freudianism for the notion of sublimation, which was all the more necessary in the era of mass consumption. The social basis for this second moment in applied psychoanalysis lay in the intellectuals. Whereas earlier intellectuals had been traditional intellectuals whose self-understanding descended from the role of the clerics in medieval society, the 20s produced the first generation of organic intellectuals who performed newly specialized social functions previously undertaken by the capitalist class itself, such as technicians, managers, engineers, social workers, advertising writers, film directors, and psychotherapists. This class, new class of the 1920s, identified Freud with a kind of intellectuality and self-reflection missing from the capitalist workplace. Lincoln Steffens captures the almost revolutionary impact of Freudianism, on this new class in his recollection of an iconic evening in 1911 at a Greenwich Village salon. The discussion, Steffens wrote, I'm quoting, introduced us to the idea that the minds of men were distorted by unconscious suppressions. There were no warmer, quieter, more intensely thoughtful conversations at this particular salon than those on Freud and his implications. This class transformed American radicalism by turning it toward cultural radicalism. The problem, however, was that the new mass consumption culture of the 20s was already itself culturally radical in the sense of being based on release from Puritanism and Victorian constraints. Therefore, a critical approach needed to reject not only Puritanism, but also had to be critical of the new culture as well. There were three possible ways to develop a critical perspective, or to deal with this question of how to deal with the new culture that developed in the 1920s. The first option was to uncritically advocate the new culture. As an example, consider Margaret Mead. In 1928, Mead went to Samoa to show that a supposedly immutable psychoanalytic category, female adolescence, which was then being applied to the flapper, the young woman, was actually culturally molded. The extended Samoan family, Mead explained, seems to ensure the child against the development of the crippling attitudes which have been labeled Oedipus complex Oedipus complexes, Electra complexes, and so forth. In contrast to Freudianism, which according to Mead lacks a theory of culture, Mead advocated toleration, diversity, and pluralism. The value of learning about different cultures, she explained, is that it teaches us that cultures cannot be judged by a single standard. Knowledge of what was soon to be called cultural diversity readies America, these are quotes, for what it needs most: education for choice, preparing its young ones to recognize and embrace the unprecedented varieties of lifestyles available to them. Many years later, Lionel Trilling remarked that whenever he hears the criticism that Freud lacked a theory of culture, he is sure that the next thing he will hear is some version of Freud's theory of culture. This is true of Mead. But while she was often uncritical about the new mass culture, the second option, the Frankfurt School, rejected it in an overstated way. According to Adorno, mass support for fascism, like the power of consumer culture, demonstrated that psychological motivation in the old liberalistic sense had disappeared. Narcissistic regression and the idealization of the mass idol allowed powerless individuals to secure infinite celebrity. As a result, the ego lost its living space and became incapable of sustaining itself as distinct from the id and the superego. So this was a second alternative, was the Frankfurt School. The focus on sublimation and the emphasis on the ego was between these two extremes. Many African-American intellectuals, for example, recognized that it was not enough to throw off the shackles of Jim Crow, but also necessary to work through the trauma of slavery. In a 1921 review of Eugene O'Neill's The Emperor Jones, Jean Toomer wrote, "The contents of the unconscious not only vary with individuals, they are differentiated because of race." Jones lived through sections of an unconscious which is peculiar to the Negro. Slave ships, whipping posts, and so forth. His fear becomes a Negro's fear, recognizably different from a similar emotion modified by other racial experience. O'Neill's plays were efforts to enact the layers of personal and cultural past that constitute the unconscious in the hope of communal group processes with the theater of working through. The Emperor Jones, Toomer wrote, is a section of Negro psychology presented in significant dramatic form. The experimental drama of the 20s, Freudian, had a long aftermath, which includes the construction of a psychoanalytic clinic in Harlem by Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, the birth of post-colonial thought in Frantz Fanon's work, and in some forms of contemporary ideas such as collective memory. One can also see the long-term effect of this Freudian way of understanding culture in Raoul Pick's recent documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, where we see James Baldwin, not necessarily identifying himself as Freudian, but he reflects the times. He says, he asks white America, why do you need a Negro? And so this is a question, a demand for self-reflection that was characteristic, it grew out of that of this period of Freudian radicalism. Let us now summarize the second moment of applied psychoanalysis. The fundamental idea was strengthening the individual ego. The idea of the ego needs to be distinguished from the idea of the self. The ego is a psychical agency. Even if it originates in narcissism, it is not bound to it. It can encompass it and situate it. We see this idea of the ego in the films of the Popular Front era, in which an individual resists a tyrant, Spartacus, or a lynch mob, the Oxbow incident, or an out-of-control jury, 12 Angry Men. The freedom of the individual from group pressures also helps explain the high ethical value mid-century psychoanalysis placed on sexuality. Two people who are sexually involved with one another have little or no interest in the group, but rather want to be free of the group, as in George Orwell's 1984, which was published in 1949, or Thomas Mann's Mario and the Magician, which is about Italian fascism. A strong, healthy, democratic group is one that can support the couple's independence. A weak, pathological group cannot. This stress on the individual did echo classical liberalism, but on the positive side, it can be understood as the Freudian contribution to social democracy. As World War II approached, Freud's thinking inspired an enormous literature on family, education, culture, and politics, all aiming to specify the psychological prerequisites of a democratic citizenry. After 1945, Cold War liberals projected the irrationality of their society onto the totalitarian countries, but social democratic Freudians, or Freudian social democrats, had seen unconscious group processes in consumer culture as well. Freudian anti-communism thereby contained a self-critical dimension that liberal anti-communism did not. On the negative side, however, there's no question that Freudianism, certainly in its American form, increasingly fell into the dichotomy of the rational individual and the irrational group, ignoring the many forms of group learning that characterized interwar America and leading to a call for a new Freudianism, which we see in the 1960s. And then that's my third example revolves around the new left and the radical feminism of the 1960s and 70s. This period saw an outpouring of Freudian political thought by such figures as Herbert Marcuse, Norman O'Brown, Juliet Mitchell, Christopher Lasch, and Jacques Lacan, all seeking to understand the unconscious dimensions of the transformation of capitalism in the late 20th century. This was also a period of enormous changes in the practice of psychoanalysis, including greater awareness of the object-seeking nature of the human being, the drawing of a sharp distinction between negative transference and resistance, recognition of the importance of enactment and projective identification, concepts that are important not only for understanding psychoanalytic treatment, but also for understanding groups. The overall reason for the interest in psychoanalysis in that period lay in the global transformation of traditional patriarchal structures provoked by the spread of markets and of capitalism itself. As in the era of mass consumption, a new way of thinking developed out of struggles around psychoanalysis. The original attitude of the radicals and counterculture of the 60s toward Freud was ambivalent. In the 50s, Freud's thought had been adapted to a McCarthyite ethic of maturity, responsibility, and adulthood. The progressive view, as Margaret Mead's work suggested, was that Freud stood for innate aggression, patriarchal family, and women's inferiority. And even those who were sympathetic to psychoanalysis recognized that ego psychology was becoming sterile. On the other hand, path-breaking reinterpretations of Freud, such as Herbert Marcuse's Eros and Civilization and Norman O'Brown's Life Against Death, claim to discern a hidden revolutionary trend in Freudianism. The novelty of Marcuse and Brown's approach lay in discovering this trend not in sexuality, where Reich found it, nor in the secondary narcissism or self-love uncovered by the Frankfurt School, but rather in primary narcissism, the infantile well of union and merger with the mother's body, which Freud had called the oceanic feeling, and which reflected a deeper regression than the ego psychologists were familiar with. Although neither Brown nor Marcuse used Melanie Klein's work, they might well have drawn on such Kleinian notions as projective identification, which describes the nonverbal forms of communication and control that pass between mother and child, or therapist and patient, between lovers, but also in among members of a group, and also Winnicott's idea of the transitional object, which is to, an attempt to describe the space between individuals rather than simply within individuals. To understand the uses to which Marcuse and Brown put their idea of primary narcissism, one has to understand that at the time they wrote, both books were published in 1955, intellectuals on the left generally presupposed the ultimate overcoming of capitalism. This assumption lies behind Marcuse's distinction between surplus repression and necessary repression, the surplus being caused by capitalism, and Brown's still dazzling analysis of the relations between anality and money, which can be found in his chapter on Martin Luther. Marcuse and Brown developed their critique of what they call the ego from not only a Freudian but also a Marxian point of view. In Marcuse's words, the ego was an aggressive, offensive subject, a subject against an object. Nature, Marcuse wrote, was given to the ego as something that had to be fought, conquered, and even violated. Against this productivist, warlike, and soon to be called masculinist conception, Marcuse identified artists and homosexuals as the vanguard of a new society based on play rather than work. Anti-capitalist though he was, instead of Marx's hero, Prometheus, Marcuse celebrated the homosexual poet-musician Orpheus, who, quote, rejected the normal eros not for an ascetic ideal, but for a fuller eros. The transformation of traditional and patriarchal authority everywhere in the world lay behind the youth-led revolt of the 60s. The essence of this revolt was its challenge to existing systems of authority. But what was new was, first, the general character of the challenge, and second, the idea of participatory democracy. The gist of this idea was that equality, which is a classic goal of the left, was not an individual quality that could be measured as wages or benefits could be measured, but rather that equality was an experience, and an experience that was only possible in groups. For this reason, the idea of primary narcissism, the unconscious connections between people and between the individual and the world, resonated with the new leftist idea of participatory democracy. We can see this in this new way of thinking in such creations of the 60s as the fervor of the crowd, the blurring of sexual boundaries, the beings, the huge crowd formations for civil rights and for peace in Vietnam, the demonic music and art, communes, the scorn for property, new art forms like happenings, newsreel, and living theater, altered states of consciousness, which is drugs, as well as an activist culture whose only regulative ideal was participation. These phenomena reflected what Lou Andreas Salome called narcissism's potentiality for conjugation and fusion. This was the moment when societal and gendered distinctions dissolved, the antinomian moment, which abstracts the individual from his or her social context and brings her face to face with God. Christine Ross has called this new left moment disidentification, writing, May 68 had little to do with the social group, social students or youth, who were its instigators. It had much more to do with the flight from social determinants, with displacements that took people out of their location in society, with a disjunction, that is, between political subjectivity and the social group, the social place. Ross also calls this the shattering of social identity that allowed politics to take place. Many of the important ideas of the late 20th century, such as deconstruction, postmodernism, cultural transgression in the Judith Butler form, the theory of recognition, is Hannett and Taylor, have common roots in the crowd experiences of the 1960s, divergent as their other roots are. This is clearly the case with feminism and gay liberation. New left antinomianism, with its fantasies of primitive merger, its blurring of identity, and huge crowd formations, prepared the way for the explosive redefinition of the women's community, which was based on the idea of the woman-identified woman, whether overtly as in lesbianism or in the sublimated form of women's loyalty to women. Loosening the ties that bound women to men, feminists strengthened the ties that bound women to one another. The result was a joyful reunion among mothers and daughters, or sisters and sisters, the intense feelings of pleasure released, indicating the lifting of a repression, especially in the form of consciousness-raising groups. That was the context in which psychoanalysis, redefined as feminist theory manqué, was revised into a relational or self-object or recognition-based form, which has its roots in Marcuse's critique of the ego and valorization of primary narcissism. What I'm suggesting is that the New Left and feminism should not be seen only as two distinct movements, but also as a continuous group process in which boundaries were dissolved and reconstituted. To be sure, there was an important difference between the two moments, and by that I don't mean the New Left and feminism, I mean the late 60s and the early 70s, between the two moments. But I don't think that the difference is fully captured by calling the first moment sexist and the second egalitarianism. Whereas the antinomianism of the late 60s generated disidentification, a shattering of social identity, the emotional drive in the 70s lay in identification, the earliest tie with another person, the basis for the building up of the self, and the mechanism of group formation. This was the triumph of narcissism in a group psychological form. What appeared from one perspective as solidarity across difference was, from another, self-assertion for the members of the group. In 1970, the Gay Liberation Front was formed, describing itself as a nationwide coalition of revolutionary homosexual organizations creating a radical counterculture. Politically, it's part of the radical movement working to suppress and eliminate discrimination and oppression. But a few years later, homosexuals began to think of themselves as persons with a distinct way of life, persons who belong to a historically specific community. Homosexuality then became an identity. Here, then, are three moments of Freudian group psychology. The idea that groups are based on identification or narcissism, the idea that culture is layered, but that mass culture works through group processes that mobilize narcissism, and the idea that regressive mass behavior can foster cultural and social change. This may sound like progress, and in some ways it was. Yet at each stage, also, much was overstated, distorted, and forgotten. In this regard, let me end by calling attention to Christopher Lasher's Culture of Narcissism, which appeared in 1978. Lasher's goal was to distinguish a rational critique of traditional paternal authority from the global antinomianism of the 1960s. According to Lasher, just as we can't do without the ego, we can't do without the superego. In his words, without the inhibiting, controlling, and guiding function of the superego, which largely merges with the ego, internal values and principles lose their efficacy, and the management of personal impressions or networking takes their place. At the same time, the primitive, irrational, punishing superego of early childhood lives on. We see this in the aftermath of the student and feminist movements in the form of political correctness, and in American culture as a whole through the 1968 election of a law and order candidate, Nixon, who claimed to represent, and these are all quotes, the silent majority, and who mobilized large majorities against rioters, draft dodgers, and rich white kids. A generation later, Richard Rorty warned that the working class may, quote, decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man. Let me conclude. What I've tried to show is that the Freudian exploration of group psychology forms a continuous story. The story begins with the father complex, which is to say overturning repression, continues with working through and concludes with what I would like to call regression in the service of the ego. Each of the three moments had limitations that led to a new initiative. The new initiative was an advance, but introduced further limitations. The first moment was the discovery of the unconscious itself, a discovery of a new way of thinking about inner psychical life, motivation, and sexuality. That discovery brought with it a certain suppression of our knowledge of outer reality, society, and politics, as Reich grasped. The second moment, working through, aimed to remedy this lacuna. The concept of the ego was a great advance over simplistic notions of revolution, but it too came at a cost, absorption into an anti-leftist liberal tradition. The result was a third moment, the discovery of narcissism, which is to say of the pre-Oedipal roots of the ego. But this advance was also made at a cost. The meaning of narcissism was reduced to self-esteem, empowerment, or romantic images of human nature symbiosis, and the entire history of Freudian struggle that had generated so much of the new left and so much feminist consciousness was forgotten. What do we learn from this sequence? Is there a fourth stage in the making? If so, I suggest that there is much to be learned from this history. The power of identification on both the left and the right, its influence on racial, gender, and sexual politics, the key role played by authority and the powerful longing for authority, which extends far beyond material necessity, the truly destructive effects of mass culture, including its cybernetic forms, the layered or stratified dimension of culture, the possibilities of collective self-reflection in a group setting, the unconscious communications that occur in groups at moments of crisis, the role of group psychology in social and cultural change, the ever-present likelihood of regression, repetition, forgetting, and the wishful tendencies of the human mind, which make progress rare and hard to hold on to. Thank you.